From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Between 1983 and 1992, Jonathan Williams traveled the back roads of the Southeast with Guy Mendes or Roger Manley and their cameras riding shotgun. The eccentric poet covered nine states in search of what he called outlandish art. Mendes and Manley photographed sprawling environments like Howard Finster's Paradise Garden in Somerville, Georgia, and Land of Passaquan in Marion County, Georgia. They made portraits of Annie Hooper and of Thornton Dial and Lonnie Holly, whose work now lives alongside Pollock's and Picasso's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Photographs and art from their trips are now gathered at an exhibition called Way Out There, The Art of Southern Back Roads, and it's running through May 19th at the High Museum of Art here in Atlanta. Roger Manley joins me now from Durham, North Carolina. Hello, Roger.
Howdy.
And Guy Mendes is with us from Lexington, Kentucky. Hello, Guy.
How are y'all doing?
Well, just fine and excited to talk with you guys. This is an amazing show, to my mind. You're both photographers, and you both took these 2 and 3 week jaunts with Jonathan Williams, separately, I should say, piling into his car, nicknamed Okra, and setting off on this adventure. What was traveling with him like?
Jonathan was a trip. I mean, besides, he was a big guy, 6'5" or so, and the car was very small. And he gesticulated a lot while driving, especially if he had Mahler or Delius or some composer on a cassette tape or something. But he also was a brilliant guy who knew a whole lot more than I ever knew about, you know, a lot of things. And so I was all ears and all eyes. And it was, you know, like a rolling school of Athens. I learned a lot.
He died in 1994. What do you remember about him, Roger?
Well, just being around Jonathan, he was the sort of ultimate conversationalist because he knew so many different things about so many different things. And it went everywhere from arcane baseball statistics to, geological formations to, he could just talk about anything and in depth and very knowledgeably about anything. So it was just great fun to ride around with him. And, he he loved elegant food and fancy restaurants just as much as barbecue joints and, places where people are cooking pigs on bed springs. So, he was just great to be around.
So where did you start? Did you even have a map?
I started with him in Georgia, in Atlanta. We got in the car with, I think, Lucinda Bunnan and Virginia Smith and maybe Tom Patterson, and we went to see Howard Finster, and that was back in the early 80s. And in between, I would meet Jonathan in Atlanta, and we would go to Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and come back to Atlanta. And I think the last trip we made, we came back to Atlanta, and he announced that we were going to have lunch with Harry Callahan and Eleanor Callahan, the great photographer who Jonathan studied with at Black Mountain College and at the Institute of Design or the Art Institute in Chicago. And Harry and Eleanor Callahan are famous in photographic lore. So it was great to meet them and show them our Polaroids from the trip, because back then, there was no digital, there was no cell phones and so forth. But we did take Polaroids that we could show people and give to people that we photographed. Mm. And so it was a trip to show Harry Callahan, a master of, fine printing and whatnot, these little Polaroids. But he liked them because they were of these way out people.
Yeah, tell us about Howard Finster's this Paradise Garden. There is Finsterfest, by the way, coming up on May 26th and 27th. That's every year, Memorial Weekend. It opens up his garden to art. What did you see there, Guy, when you first got to Howard Finster's garden?
Oh, just a wondrous place. I mean, every inch of the walkway and every building was festooned with ornaments and objects and sayings and a long torpedo, said, there will be wars in last days. And, it was all very prophetic and high and mighty, but also pretty low down. And, a kind of renegade preacher who talked a mile a minute and was a wonderful guy.
Yeah, Howard.
What about
was,
you, Roger?
I went to Howard's with Jonathan one time too, and later went a bunch more times with Tom Patterson working on a book project about Howard. But that first encounter, visit was pretty overwhelming. I mean, Howard had really set out to collect one of every man-made object on Earth and pretty much had everything. I mean, you could hardly name anything that he didn't already have. It might not work. It might be broken, but at least he had it, you know, and you could the walls of his garden were just embedded with everything from tonsils to canceled checks to pictures of Trish and Dick Nixon and pistols and cash registers, anything you can name. He had some and had put them in there because it was, for him, he saw what he was doing as saving the inventions of mankind for after the apocalypse. You know, we would theoretically be sort of reduced to the Middle Ages again, and he would have everything there so that you could figure it out and put it all back together. He saw himself as kind of like the Noah of technology, you know, would save human inventions for the future.
That is Roger Manley. I'm speaking with him and Guy Mendes, both artists and photographers, and both of their work is on display with artworks from some original outlandish artists, as Jonathan Williams, the poet who inspired this trip, was looking for at Way Out There. It's the Art of Southern Back Roads. It's on view at the High Museum of Art. Well, so this is the thing. You're taking photographs of people in their personal spaces, their homes, in the case of Howard Finster, something he does want to show to the world. But some of these people had been preyed upon. How did they greet you?
People were quite happy to see us, I'll have to say. I mean, in general, they were thrilled that somebody was paying attention, because a lot of these people make art for the purpose of reestablishing themselves in the community, for trying to find their way again, and they were just happy that someone would slow down and take notice, because often within their own communities, people would be suspicious of what they were doing. You know, a lot of the people were the kind of people that parents would warn their children to stay away from that place because that guy's kind of bizarre. And when we would come along and treat them like normal people or, you know, admire what they were doing, they would light up.
We made an occasion of the visit, too. It's one thing I learned from Jonathan was that, and from others like Gene Meatyard, who was a photo mentor of mine, you show up somewhere, you're there to celebrate them and to pay attention to them and bring them and their work to light. And we felt a little bit like Walker Evans during the South during the, you know, Depression days, and photographing sharecroppers and other people who had no voice or no way of getting their ideas and whatnot out there. And so I think people saw us as, you know, we weren't preying on them. We weren't dealers. We weren't there to, you know, make them a big deal other than to put them in a book. And we're a little late, 30 years late, getting the book out, but thanks to Philip Jones and the Institute 193, we have this wonderful book, Walks to the Paradise Garden, a lowdown Southern odyssey that is 300 pages. What is it, Roger? 300 and something pages here. 350 pages.
It's a big book. Yeah, about 350 pages.
And it's a book of wonders, really, and of wondrous people that took us in and told us their stories. And another photographer mentor of mine, James Baker Hall, always said a good portrait is given as much as it is taken. These people gave of themselves, and we worked hard, you know, to provide, you know, good photographs of them.
Mm. I'd love to know more about that story, because these Williams, I guess Jonathan Williams originally envisioned this as a travel guide, but it never got published. And then the curator and artist, Philip March Jones, he pulled this all together, these photographs and photographs of the works and narrative, some from Williams himself, in this book, Walks to Paradise Garden, A Lowdown Southern Odyssey. This was published in 2019. So it was started to be assembled when you were on the road, but not published until this year. So what was it like going through the archives to assemble this book?
time-consuming because the pictures and slides and had been in boxes on shelves in both of our studios, Roger's and mine, and gathering dust for 30 years. And Roger, how did you feel when Philip came to you and said we're going to do this?
First off, I was, you know, amazed that anybody was still interested. But I think a lot of the reasons that other publishers had balked about it was that they had wanted everything done up in a neat, sort of orderly, fashion. Whereas I feel like the book, as Philip envisioned it and Jonathan envisioned it, and the way it came out is very lifelike in a way. It sort of has a sort of random, discovery quality. You're never quite sure what's going to be on the next page. It's not an attempt to treat everybody like an insect, you know, pinned to a board. There, each chapter has a slightly different take. Some are funny, some are sad, you know, some are kind of random thoughts on Jonathan's part or other things that were happening in the world at the time. And, you know, it has a real living experience, just like a cross-country trip actually does.
Hmm. Now, I understand, Guy, that you originally wanted this to be called the Lowdown Way Out Guide. What was your original concept for it?
My original title was Way Out People, Way Out There, because it's descriptive. You know, they were way out there, and they were way out. And it's like we were looking for conjurers, and we found them. And then we, in turn, became conjurers, conjuring them up. And the first couple of outsider or folk artists or self-taught artists I met, one was a man named Henry Dorsey outside of Louisville in Brownsboro, Kentucky, and he'd built a contraption all across the front of his house that when he turned cranks and levers, doors would open and birds would spin around and, you know, there were things were revealed, and he couldn't speak anymore because he'd had a stroke, but he could point at things and crank things, and his eyes just lit up because he was filled with delight at the work he had done, and he enjoyed showing it. And then I got to know and meet Edgar Tolson, the woodcarver. And but back home in New Orleans, I grew up in New Orleans, and I went to Kentucky to go to school and stayed because I had good teachers and good friends. And but I returned to New Orleans a lot, and one of my friends there, Alan Jaffe of Preservation Hall, introduced me to Sister Gertrude Morgan, and I arranged to go see her at her small Everlasting Gospel Revelation Mission, which is about a shotgun house with about three rooms and all painted white. And I sat across a little table about 3 feet from her, and she picked up a megaphone and started singing at me and preaching at me. And along with my mother, Sister Gertrude came as close as anybody to giving me religion. So. That was, and she painted Jesus in herself in an airplane that sort of looked like Wonder Woman's plane because it had no roof or anything, and just them sitting on the wings. But her credo was, Jesus is my airplane, and he takes me so high. And that just blew me away. So.
Well, that's part of the thing that in some of these, I'm thinking of The Cross Garden. I can't remember the artist. Mom in Hell from Sex, Sister in Hell from Sex. The kind of apocalyptic visions of what's going to happen to you, these prophecies instilling fear. And then there are others, these kind of heavenly, otherworldly visions.
Devils and angels.
We were talking about sort of conversion experiences. When I was a freshman in college, I'd had a really terrible first semester and frankly, I failed some courses and was afraid to go home and confront my dad, who was paying for me to go to college. And so instead of going home at Christmas, I headed to the Outer Banks of North Carolina and on a hitchhiking trip, and realized soon after I'd gotten out there that it was a pretty big mistake because it was terrible weather and hardly any traffic, and nobody likes to pick up a 250-pound wet person. And, and finally I got picked up and dropped off at this very ordinary-looking house. It was the grandmother of the guy that gave me the ride, and he said, "You can, you know, maybe you can dry off in at my grandmother's house." And on the outside, it looked perfectly normal, like a regular old North Carolina house, sort of white clapboard, you know, weatherboards. And but inside, inside the house was filled with about 3,500. Sculptures that she'd made out of driftwood and concrete that told about 300 stories from the Bible. And it was just the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. I'd never seen anything like that. And later, when I got back to campus, I tried to tell people about it, and nobody could quite envision it. So I went back the second time at Easter and took photographs. And something about showing those pictures to people would trigger, you know, they would kind of get it. And I would show the photographs of Annie's house, Annie Hooper's house.
This was Annie Hooper.
Right. And the house was, say, completely full, so full that she had tiny pathways through the sculpture, and she had to use a yardstick to flip the lights on and off. You know, couldn't reach the walls anymore. And but when I show those pictures, they would say, "Oh, I know someone like that. There's a guy in our town who's making dinosaurs out of car bumpers," or, you know, "Or I know somebody like that. There's a we have a relative who collects mule dung that looks like the president of the United States," and that sort of thing. So, you know, and I would go visit them, and it sort of snowballed over the time. Each time you visit more people.
Well, I'm speaking with the artists and photographers Guy Mendes and Roger Manley. Way Out There, The Art of the Southern Backroads, is a new exhibit of their work at the High Museum of Art. And we're going to learn more about what they found along those backroads and hear more about that experience after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with Roger Manley and Guy Mendes. They're artists, they're photographers, and they went on a monumental road trip, or a series of them, rather, between 1983 and 1992, with the pretty eccentric poet Jonathan Williams, traveling the back roads of the Southeast, taking photographs of self-taught artists and their artworks. It was originally intended to be a guide, but it is only 30 years later been put together into a book and now an exhibit at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta. In the book, Philip March Jones uses Williams' words, "We make beauty out of the air and out of nowhere." How did you capture that inspiration, that the absolute singular vision, you know, a woman with thousands of dolls out of driftwood in her house telling stories of St. Om down in Pasaquan, creating a whole cosmology?
Well, it told me you could spend your life working to picture the world, the world around you, and in your own particular way. And I mean, I learned from all these artists that, you know, the power of persistence and working it, keep making things until you please yourself, you know, and you hardly ever get pleased because you want to make more.
Yeah, I think the thing about all these artists is they didn't set out to be artists. They were almost always responding to some kind of tragedy or, you know, setback in their lives. You know, maybe they had lost their job, or their, you know, the factory closed, or their spouse died, or they had an industrial accident or something. And then, you know, and these kind of things happen to all kinds of people, and all kinds of, you know, people react in different ways. Some retrain to try to find a new job. Some move to a different part of the country. But there's like a tiny percentage of people who respond to the big life setback by beginning to make things. And they just do it because it makes them feel better. And I don't mean that it's like therapeutic art. It's just that they just kind of reestablishes their sense of self-worth or self-value. And then it begins to kind of feed on itself. You know, if you fill your yard with crosses or, you know, chainsawed animals or something like that, pretty soon people will start slowing down and, you know, pointing at your house and you know, getting out of their car and coming up and talking to you. And you've kind of regained the attention of everybody by sort of stating your presence in the community. And that, you know, I thought there was something really kind of noble about it. You know, that none of them said, oh, I better take an art course or, yeah, where's the nearest art supply house? They just used whatever they had at hand and you know, whatever was in their shed or their backyard or out in the woods and got to work.
Mm. Another person you photographed, Z.B. Armstrong Roger, said he was visited by an angel who warned him of the end of the world and started making these wooden doomsday clocks.
Yeah, I mean, well, Z.B. was, that was a pretty funny situation. Z.B. was both interested in predicting the end of the world, but also, I have to say, a little bit interested in making money on it, because he figured that if he could find out when the end of the world was, he cooked up a scheme, which was kind of a, I guess you would say, like a pyramid scheme or a Ponzi scheme, but where people would contribute a small amount of money, like 25 cents a week. You know, you go around and collect the money with the promise that it would be repaid in triplicate on the, you know, a certain day. But he had calculated that certain day would be after the end of the world, so he would never have to do it, which I thought was pretty ingenious.
I'm speaking with Roger Manley and Guy Mendes. They are both photographers, have done a lot of different kinds of work, but we're talking about some great road trips that they took back in the 80s and 90s, photographing self-taught artists across the Southeast. Their work and the work of some of those artists is collected at the High Museum. The show is called Way Out There. I would like to talk more about the idea of, you know, kind of making money, not necessarily by investing in the doomsday clock, but by selling work. And that's something that at this time in the 80s, you know, there were definitely galleries, there were definitely collectors of people who were buying this kind of art. Some of these people, of course, had been preyed upon or maybe exploited. But there's also there's an opportunism in there. Williams wrote a little poem called Mose Tolliver Among the Carpetbaggers. You know, there's this notion that people are coming out there and telling them what to paint so that they can buy stuff. But were these people that you spoke to making money or living off art?
I would say very few were actually living off their art, if any. Howard Finster was probably a big exception in that, you know, he after he gained a good deal of notoriety, he was quite aware of the fact that his work was selling. The thing to keep in mind about Howard was that he never really thought of himself. I mean, even though he would say I'm an artist, he really thought of himself as a preacher. And he considered his rivals not other artists but other evangelists, and he would say things like, "You don't see anybody buying Jerry Falwell's sermons and hanging them on their wall, do you? You know, nobody's paying for Jim Baker's sermons and putting frames around them, are they? You know, so it's that kind of those are the people that he saw as his peers, were the televangelists and people like that, that he thought he was doing better than they were because he was actually selling his ministry and able to kind of keep it going. And it certainly did keep it going. He was probably the most prolific artist maybe in all of history. I mean, he made 46,000 works of art. I mean, that's doing pretty good, you know.
Every one of them numbered.
Yeah, every one of them numbered. I mean, when you compare that to Vermeer, who's known for like 21 paintings or something, it's pretty overwhelming, you know. So,
and there's also a level of obsessiveness in that too, you know, in that kind of level of detail.
Yeah, Howard was an insomniac. He basically worked around the clock and survived mostly on popsicles and pickles and little Debbies and things like that. He had the world's worst you know, you would think the world's worst diet, but it kept him going year after year. And I loved being around him. I mean, Guy mentioned that he was a talker. He really was the world's most talkative person. To get away from Howard, you just had to get in your car. He was still talking to you. And you'd slowly roll the windows up and wave as you drove away because he would still be talking. And that was the only way you could kind of, you know, extricate yourself from the situation. But he had a great take on everything. You know, it was fun to be around him. And he was a really deeply loving person. But every now and then something funny would happen. Like I was at his place one time and I was watching a football game with his grandson. And Howard was off in some other part of his garden working on something. And then he came in to either have another Diet Coke or a Popsicle and saw us watching this football game. And he said, "That's the damn dumbest thing I've ever seen." He said, "The people on that end want to go to the other end. The people on that end want to go to the other end. Why don't they just trade places?" You know. So, you know, and when you think about it, you know, he's kind of right. That was the great thing. It sort of gave a whole new spin on things.
It would have changed that game a whole lot. And life, oh, yeah. And life in Georgia a whole lot. Guy, you also, I believe you both took photographs of Passaquan. This is in South Georgia. This is Eddie Owens Martin, known as St. Ohm, E-O-M, for his initials, created that space, which was for many years in decline, but has recently been resuscitated. What did you see there?
Well, the land of Passaquan was just an amazing place, is an amazing place, and driving out from Buena Vista, Georgia, to get there, you drive through a lot of kudzu-lined roads. And in the book that Tom Patterson and the Jargon Society with Jonathan Williams did of the land of Passaquan, it starts out with a series of black and white images that, once you get to Passaquan, turn into color, like the yellow brick road in the Wizard of Oz, because color is just brilliant everywhere at Passaquan. Eddie had his own style. He kind of derived it from various things like the Lost Continent of Mu or something, Roger, was written about. Eddie was a soothsayer. He had his own gowns and headdresses and whatnot. He read coffee grounds and other things for people. He told us that he said, "Yeah, the black folks come to get their lucky number, try and win the lottery." He said, "White folks come because they're in the love trap." And I was like, "Yeah, I've been in the love trap. Okay, like, read my fortune." But, you know, he lived not far from the land of Passaquan wasn't far from Plains, and where the Carters lived. And Jimmy Carter came by to visit him not long after he'd lost to Reagan. And St. Ohm told Jimmy Carter that the reason he lost to Reagan was because Reagan had what all America wanted, a good head of hair and a mean line of talk. And that sounds kind of familiar these days, doesn't it?
I guess Jimmy didn't have a chance in that case.
No. For both of us, I think it was the encounter with these people that just told the truth, you know, and they were just so interesting and so kind of fun to meet. I remember St. Ohm or Eddie Martin, same guy, talking about his, you know, he made a living as a fortune teller, that's how he sort of paid for working on his land of Passaquan. And he said, "I always tell women their husbands are going to die. They cry, but they like to hear it."
That's like Carl McKenzie, a woodcarver up near Nada, Kentucky, near the Red River Gorge, told me and Jonathan. He said his wife had passed away, and he said, "Yeah, what I need to find me a rich widow with a bad cough."
Well, so, okay, here's a question. I mean, you're doing this trip when American sprawl is in full force in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, the big box stores are popping up everywhere and the chain stores on those stretches in and out of towns across America. And yet these environments, some of them, like Pasaquan, for years was just sort of abandoned until it was picked up by the Kohler Foundation. Lonnie Hawley's environment plowed over by the Airport Authority in Alabama. You know, others, they did just left to crumble because there was no sense of value in this art. Did you get the sense that you were preserving something, a way of life that we may never see again?
Well, I don't think there's a chance that we'll never see it again. I mean, I think there's still people doing this work. What's different is that nowadays they'll be working on it for about 3 days and then it'll go on YouTube and you know, somebody will... It's hard for a place to get fully developed without anybody out of the community knowing about it now, whereas back then... You know, people would work on something for years and years, and then finally, you know, people elsewhere would hear about it.
And back then, you know, we were working on living, breathing artists. We were hoping to get out the word about people who were in the middle of their artistic lives. And now, we're looking back 30 years, and most of them are gone. There are only a handful of people in the book that are still alive, I think.
Yeah, maybe two or three.
But in the age of, you know, internet reaching everywhere, this kind of singular visions, uninfluenced and isolated on some level, still possible.
These days?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, not all of it is out in the, you know, out on view. A lot of things happen inside people's houses or, you know, in their shed out back or, you know, there's still things happening. People still... And I think there always will be. I mean, as long as people are having life setbacks of one sort or another, and there's going to be people who are going to respond by making things because it just works. You know, it helps them overcome whatever they're dealing with.
I'd like to say the book Walks to the Paradise Garden is a wonderful book. We're thrilled to have it. It's going to last a long time. The show is only going to be up till the middle of May at the High Museum, way out there. And they did a wonderful job with it, the combination of Jonathan Williams' poems, concrete poems, found poems, with objects from their collection, objects by Eddie Owens Martin and Finster and others, and our photographs. And, you know, they're arrayed over about five rooms on two floors, and it's just a beautiful exhibit, probably the most beautiful exhibit I've ever been in, and I'm thrilled to be part of it, and I know Roger is too.
Yeah, we were both blown away by it when we saw it for the first time, completely better than I expected.
Guy Mendes and Roger Manley, we've been speaking with them about Way Out There, the art of the Southern Back Roads. It runs through May 19th at the High Museum of Art. There's a lot more information. There's a map of where they took photographs. You can learn much more about the show when the High Museum hosts a talk with the exhibit's curators, Philip March Jones, Catherine Gentleson, and Gregory Harris, on Thursday, March 28th at 7. Details at gpbnews.org. And in closing, we will leave you with John the Revelator by Sun House, who is one of the artists who is featured in the show at the High Museum of Art. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alex Word is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for joining us today for On Second Thought.
John the Revelator wrote the book of the seven seas. You know, God walked down in the cool of the day, called Adam by his name. And he refused to answer because he's naked and ashamed. Who's that writing? John the Revelator. Who's that writing? John the Revelator. Who's that writing? John the Revelator wrote the book of the seventh sea. You know, Christ had 12 apostles and 3 leaders.